Yes, the beasts of the field pant toward you, because the flood of water in the stream beds has dried up, and a burning has consumed the sweet pastures of the desert. You, meaning Jehovah, yes, the beasts of the field pant toward you, because the flood of water in the stream beds has dried up, and a burning has consumed the sweet pastures of the desert. I think I'm avoiding my letter P's because I don't want to make a pop noise on the microphone, but I shouldn't do that because it ends up sounding rather strange sometimes. But this is now Joel, the end of the chapter we just did, the last verse of chapter 1 of Joel, 1 and 20. That concludes chapter 1 of Joel, the prophet, his book. In the Ward Green translation of 2003. And so tomorrow we'll be doing something else, hopefully, in that same translation. But we have here, for today's study, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express chapter, well, part 2, first of all, and it's chapter 10. Paragraph 4, illustrated at the beginning with this hieratic Egyptian alphabet sample from the Edwin Smith papyrus. That's what it looks like. Hard to really know what the full line height is here on this text. It's, well, here we see, there it is, you can see from the red color here. One of the lines is colored red, so we see that that's the height of a line, which is sort of double the height of some of the more elongated characters there. It's a very ornamental language. It looks rather much like, I mean, it's closer to no other language than to Arabic, I would say, in terms of style. I don't really know what else to compare it to as far as style goes. Somewhat like Arabic, but certainly very different from Arabic. But anyway, let's read the caption. It says there, it's dated approximately 1600 BC, this sample, this document, in fact. It's black and red ink on papyrus, 17 pages, total length 4.68 meters or 15.4 feet, 469 lines, of which 377 are on the front side, written in hieratic script of ancient Egypt, the alphabetic system from which came the Demotic, on the middle third of the Rosetta Stone, the famous Rosetta Stone, the top third of which had Egyptian hieroglyphics and the bottom third Greek. Now, this picture we looked at was a reproduction from the article Edwin Smith Papyrus on Wikipedia. Hieratic is not derived from Egyptian hieroglyphic letters, or the, as it's properly called here, the Egyptian hieroglyphic picture system. It's not derived from that, but existed along with it and was thus intimately related to it. Hieroglyphics may read right to left to right, or top to bottom, but usually read from right to left. Cursive hieroglyphs read either right to left or left to right, while hieratic, like Hebrew, always reads right to left. Early Hebrew used hieratic numerals. That's fascinating, because if early Hebrew used hieratic numerals, it implies that Hebrew was created in Egypt, doesn't it? Which would make perfect sense, because we know although many people try to say different, you know, they try to deny this thing, this fact, this knowledge that the Jews lived in Egypt, that they were in Egypt, they came out of Egypt. During the Exodus, they came out of Egypt, and they, after 40 years of wilderness wanderings, came to the Promised Land. So they, having come from Egypt, would have an alphabet. It would make sense that would be somehow connected to Egypt. So here we see there's a connection in early Hebrew to the Egyptian hieratic numerals. Now let's begin reading our paragraph for today, shall we? The Hebrew language of the Bible account is dated from the account. This is going to be a fascinating... when we see the ending of this paragraph, I think we're going to see this to be very fascinating. I really do. For patriarchal names had meaning only in Hebrew. What do you think about that? Furthermore, the Hebrew language dates back in an unbroken chain to the time of Adam, whom we determined as 5,550 BCE. That's not just a round number that we came up with. That is the actual precise date that we came up with, using the best available copies of the Bible manuscripts, which were in the Greek Septuagint. Semitic languages descending from the original tongue form a group related to what we call Hebrew and have Phoenician as a parent, despite Phoenician having been developed by a descendant of Japheth, Phineas Pharsa, from Irish tradition. The one thing I want to note in that sentence is you notice the words the original tongue. Semitic languages descending from the original tongue. That is the most fascinating, I believe. I'm trying to think of how else to put it. That's the most important. It's the most, you know, it's just the most exciting idea that there was one original tongue, right, from which all the others sprang. But originally, there was one language that was spoken by the original patriarch, Adam. And he spoke, and his children spoke, and his wife spoke, and all these original patriarchs spoke some language, right? And this is the original tongue that's being mentioned there. That, to me, is fascinating. Because what is it? How close is it to the Hebrew, for example? Now, Semitic languages, which descend from the original tongue, as we should say, all languages must, form a group related to what we call Hebrew, although some of the languages undoubtedly deviate more from the original tongue, right? But the Semitic languages descending from the original tongue form a group related to what we call Hebrew, related to what we call Hebrew, and have Phoenician as a parent, despite Phoenician having been developed by a descendant of Japheth, not a descendant of Shem, but of Japheth, Phineas Pharsa, who was that descendant of Japheth in the Irish tradition, who was at the Tower of Babel and developed this Phoenician alphabet. The oldest alphabet is conventionally dated at 2700 BCE. You see why, right? 2700 is, in fact, the same time as, roughly speaking, the Tower of Babel in our chronology, but it says here conventionally dated. Let's look at the reference number 2 here. History of the alphabet. So even the conventional dating agrees with our dating of the Tower of Babel. That's, you know, what's the word? Objectively strong evidence, right? A form of Egyptian hieroglyphic alphabet. Egyptian hieroglyphic alphabet is what the oldest alphabet is, a form of Egyptian hieroglyphic alphabet with 22 consonants. Since, now, we don't know if that's really the oldest. Yes, it is probably, because the Sumerian was older, but it was not an alphabet. It wasn't alphabetic. Letters rather than symbols or graphic. You see? So the oldest alphabet is this Egyptian hieroglyphic alphabet, 22 consonants. Since the number 22 is also the number of consonants found in the Hebrew consonantal abjad, same number of consonants, 22, in the Hebrew consonantal abjad, alphabet, in brackets, being an abjad with vowels added to it. Which, for example, is true of the Greek. It has the vowels as part of it, part of the alphabet, whereas the Hebrew did not. Just had the 22 consonants, which are the same 22 consonants of the Phoenician abjad. And since that's true, we get the alphabetic connection and some confusion occurring at the Tower of Babel. Right, because we have the oldest alphabet also having 22 consonants, although it was Egyptian. So we have the Hebrew and the Phoenician with the same number of consonants, which is 22. So it's incredible. There's an alphabetic connection, but the confusion at the Tower of Babel about 2700 BCE, roughly, right? We know it's, in our chronology, we know it's not exactly 2700, but more like 47 to 2711 or sometime like that, BCE. But it's any time between 2774 and 2705 or something like that, I guess, is the Tower of Babel we would expect. To the sacred tongue of Adam, there was some confusion added at the Tower of Babel. And that tongue of Adam was from 5550 BCE. This is confirmed at Genesis 11 and 1, where Moses writes that after the deluge, prior to the migration to Shinar, thus, before the Tower of Babel, quote, all the earth continued with one alphabet and one form of speech, end quote. That's a paraphrasing, but it says in Genesis 11:1 in Young's literal translation, and the whole earth is of one pronunciation. Pronunciation is the correct pronunciation for that word. And the whole earth is of one pronunciation and of the same words. So really, it's not clear whether they were using an alphabet at that time. You know, it's not clear, is it? Whether at the Tower of Babel they were using an alphabet at that time. Because this word pronunciation implies it's verbal, an oral, from the mouth, way of speaking, and whereas the words of the same words is more like the vocabulary. If we look at the different translations here, one language and one speech from the King James, same speech and same words from Byington, Rotherham, one manner of speech and one stock of words, or in other words, one vocabulary, you could say, too, right? Whereas it is possible, right, where it says one language, it could be talking about the alphabet. It's not really entirely possible to rule that out. So now here we have a sample of Arabic from the Quran, which is written with ink, color, and gold on parchment, written from right to left. It's in the language of Arabic, which is a Semitic consonantal abjad descended from the Phoenician, the caption says, the grammar of classical Arabic was used in the golden age of Jewish culture in Spain to help, quote, in explaining the grammar and vocabulary of biblical Hebrew. Fascinating. The grammar of Arabic was used to help in explaining the grammar and vocabulary of biblical Hebrew. Both the old Uyghur, Uyghur alphabet near the Kunlun Mountains in China and the Arabic alphabet are children of the Syriac alphabet, which is a child of Aramaic, as it is in turn an offspring of the Phoenician alphabet. So there's a very long descent line of these alphabets. It appears from that. It's fascinating. We never get enough time, you know, to study in detail everything. That's just the way things are. We can always choose to study something, you know, if we choose to take the time to do that. Arabic. It's the language. I was looking for the pronunciation there. Arabic, it looks like it's pronounced. Arabic. But we have the faithful transmission of the word of God from Adam to his son Seth, to his son Enosh, to his son Cainan. Right, that's the first Cainan, the great-grandson of Adam, all the way to Moses, who wrote the books Genesis to Deuteronomy, which is called the Torah. And that faithful transmission is a faithful precept of the genealogy of the Bible, and the provenance is passed by means of the lineage arriving at Noah and proceeding on, thus, to Shem. As writing is traditionally taught by parents to children, the most logical conclusion to draw is that Moses wrote in the language of Abraham, which is in the language of Adam. But since Abraham was descended from Shem, it was Semitic, or Shem had learned it from Noah before the deluge, Shem being the son Noah chose to preserve the sacred word. The method of writing in the sacred alphabet was recreated over time, and according to the local custom of the region. But the names of the ancestors had real meaning in Hebrew. That's the thing that is so fascinating. They must have preserved the language from the original language of Adam, because if they had not done that, it wouldn't have been possible to preserve the meaning of the ancestral names which were written in that language and which were found in the biblical Hebrew. That's the thing that is so, wow, I mean, important doesn't even do it justice. What's a word that means more than important? Monumental, I guess you could say, right? I mean, it's so monumental. It's so, let's look up the word important in the thesaurus. It's so far-reaching. It's so momentous. It's so consequential. It's so decisive. Yeah, it's so, what's the word? It's also convincing in terms of the proof, right? It convinces us of the proof that, or it serves as the proof. It convinces us of the fact that this Bible that we're reading, which was written in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, albeit, you know, a language that was from a significant time in the past, but yet the Hebrew that we have the manuscripts, you know, in is a much more recent Hebrew than the original Phoenician or the language that came out of Egypt with the Hebrews. The script is different, like the way of writing the letters is much different in the manuscripts that we have, which are from, you know, The oldest one is something like a few hundred years B.C. or something, the manuscripts. We don't have anything really that old to go back to the original scripts or anything. We don't know what sort of script Moses wrote with. Although it could have been something. We don't know. We just don't know. It could have been something like the Hebrew we have today, but not, we think not, because we do have the inscriptions that were made during the Exodus by the Israelites, right? We found these inscriptions that we've talked about in the Wild Road article, for example. I believe that's where we talked about it. But that a Semitic language like Hebrew was common to both the Semitic descendants of Shem. This is just absolutely mind-boggling that a Semitic language like Hebrew was common to both the Semitic descendants of Shem and Phineas Pharsa, a Japhethite. They both shared a Semitic language, which are represented by Hebrew and Phoenician, is abundant proof that it preceded either Shem or Japheth. This language, the original language, must have preceded either Shem or Japheth, right? Because it was found in both of their lineages. How else? You know, how else? Because, of course, Shem lived at the time of the deluge, but the Tower of Babel occurred after that, and Phineas Pharsa didn't get it from Shem. It wouldn't seem, because he wasn't a Semite. He wasn't descended from Shem. How did he get something? So it just seems like it seems more than proof. It seems like abundant proof that it's mind-bogglingly significant. It's just, isn't it? It boggles my mind. That's what, I mean, it leads you into this. Of course, it's only the beginning of proving it, you know, in great detail. You'd have to do a lot of research to prove it in all of its, you know, details. But it looks like that would be the starting point for doing a great amount of research. And, you know, it's possible. It's maybe just barely possible that conclusion is wrong, but doesn't seem likely that that's the wrong conclusion. It looks very telling, doesn't it? That this is the language used by people. And there was confusion at the Tower of Babel. And then from that came the Phoenician language. At least according to tradition, that was the language that came from Phineas Pharsa, was the Phoenician, and that bears his name. Named after Phineas, the Phoenician. It's just, we weren't taught this in school, I'll tell you that. That's not something that people knew. This is something that required a great deal of research to even get this much of a glimmer, you know, of fact. But it's just so powerful. It's a powerful piece of evidence, isn't it? It's just a powerful thing. It doesn't so much raise a lot of questions as it does appear to prove this important idea that there was a common language originally. That's what it seems to prove, it to a very high degree of proof. Like, oh, you know, Jehovah knows so much. The thing is, it's very easy to say, well, you know, people can decide, you know. You can't decide. What, like, for example, with in the Bible it says a good wife is from Jehovah. And people think, well, a man can choose his wife, but that's not really true. Why is a good wife from Jehovah? Well, it's because there's no man who can choose his own wife and make the choice a good choice. He can't make a good choice. And the fact is, only Jehovah knows individuals well enough to choose which man and which woman should be together. He's the only one who can know that. That's why it says a good wife is from Jehovah. A man can't just say, oh, I choose this woman. for one thing, he might choose the woman, but she doesn't choose him. So it can't work that way. The man doesn't choose his wife. That's not how it works. But neither does a woman choose her husband. It's got to be from Jehovah so that they both choose each other. And that only he can do that. Only he can cause them to be united and committed to each other. So in the same way, you know, in the same way, in this case, with the two languages that apparently originated with a common language, only Jehovah could have caused these two language groups, or two language types, to have existed at the same time, or, you know, also at different times in history, but in two different lineages, in such a way that it gives us evidence of the original language, which is so otherwise impossible. You know, it would be otherwise impossible to verify that there was an original language. That's the idea. This is the evidence. It's the definitive proof right there. But I mean, you know, let's find better proof if we can, of course. So anyway, that is our study for today. Yeah, the idea of, you know, so many people try to, well, they don't have enough faith, or maybe they have more faith in something else, but they have so much faith in humankind, but they don't have any faith. You only need a small amount of faith, but they don't have any of that type of faith that would allow them to believe in God. You know, so they only have the type of faith that allows them to believe in something like human wisdom or human, you know, technology or something, you know, human ability. Their own power. And of course humans have great power, great ability, but in this case we're talking about the language, which is also a human ability, isn't it? It's just one of the very many human abilities. And how can you explain human abilities in all of their, you know, in all of their complexities, and if you don't believe in a cause, you know, that Jehovah is a person and that he is the cause. But we can always lose sight of this too. Even believers can fall away. They can believe in the true God, the Creator, Jehovah. They can believe in that and then they can fall away. And at a later time, they can just forget that and start to believe in something such as, you know, some other human idea, right? So this is the thing. What makes something a human idea as compared to one that originates with God? Well, this study of the ancient original language is going to help us perhaps to distinguish between the ideas that came from the original source, from the true God, and the ones that came from later sources or less powerful sources, because humans certainly are not as powerful as an all-powerful God. They can't be. So if you believe in God, or if you believe in a power higher than human power, then human powers is no longer the most high, the most powerful. It's no longer the greatest. So that is, it's an important idea because it enables us to open our minds when we're researching, that we could open our minds to finding more powerful ideas than we've ever known, you know, than we've known up to this point, hitherto. So, No, it's a fascinating subject. It really is. Isn't it? It really is. It's just fascinating. I mean, we don't have time to study the what surely must be enormous number of details, you know, involved in alphabets and things like that. We don't have time for that, and certainly not today, but we don't have time for it in our general writing or studying either. We don't have time to write about all of it or to read it, you know, or study it. It's in all of its complexity. So if we can't study everything, because there's so much knowledge in the world and so much knowledge in all of history, if we can't study it all, what do we do? Like, what can we do? Just throw up our hands and exclaim, you know, that it's futile? Or, I mean, what do we do if we can't read everything? We can't understand or know everything. See, isn't that the best or a good reason why we benefit, whether we do it, whether we should or not, is up to us. But isn't that a good reason why we benefit from putting faith in a higher power? Because we can't do it ourselves. It's obvious. Even if we had all the humans working on it at the same time, you know, billions of us, we couldn't do enough to cover everything. It would be impossible. See, that's the reason why it takes the pressure off. It takes a lot of pressure off if we believe in a higher power. That doesn't mean it's blind faith. We still have to verify every single thing. In fact, we have to verify it even more if we believe in a higher power, because if we believe in a higher power, we are accountable, and therefore we have to make sure of as many things as we say, that is, and as many things as we do. It's important to make sure of the basis for what we're saying and doing. So it's just, but it gives us a sense of peace, doesn't it? To know that there's somebody who loves us, who's wiser than we are, and who loves us very deeply, and who has infinite wisdom. It's so much better that way, if we believe that. Now, Semitic languages, we're going to get into that maybe tomorrow a little bit more. This is December 22nd. 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 15:47 hours Canadian Eastern Time. I love you very much. I'm Ward Green, and in my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. Thank you so much for listening and watching, and that was the article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express, Chapter 10. Today we did Paragraph 4, which is a two-part paragraph. And that's it for today. I mean, we can look at some of the illustrations if you want to. You can read more. You can investigate some of the references. I'm sure there's lots to do. But that's it for now.